Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 13. I'm going to do verses 1 through 33, the entire chapter today. I'm going to call this section 12 Spies Are Sent into Canaan. Our context is this. In the last chapter 12, we saw Miriam and Aaron rebel against Moses. Miriam then caught a skin disease, had to be quarantined. And the previous chapter before that, chapter 11, we see the people complain in general about something. We don't know what it was, but God sent fire on the outskirts of the camp. And then they started complaining again about the quail, about the lack of meat, and about the manna. And so God sent them a month's worth of quail that was coming out of the nostrils, and he gave them a plague. So there's a lot of griping going on, bad times in the state of Israel. So now, and all of this happened, by the way, just 3 days' journey outside of Mount Sinai. They're on the way going north in the Sinai Peninsula, heading to the wilderness of Paran, which is right in the north of the peninsula, right there at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, at the southern end of the Araba Valley. So that's where we are now. We start with verses 1 through 15 of Numbers 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These then were their names, and I'm not going to read you their names. You're not going to remember them. I can barely pronounce them. One of their names, of course, was Hoshea. That's in verse 8, from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. That Hoshea is our famous Joshua, who has a book in the Old Testament named after him, and he's going to lead the people across the Jordan River into the Promised Land, so he's kind of mentioned there. His name is going to be changed later. But other than that, you're not going to remember these names. Now, in verse 2, it says, God tells Moses, "Send out for yourself men." God was actually acting in response to the request of the people, as NIV Study Bible points out, because we read in Deuteronomy 1, verses 22 through 23, "Then all of you approached me," and Moses is speaking, "then all of you approached me and said, 'Let us send men before us, that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way by which we should go up in the cities which we shall enter.' The thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe." So as Moses looks back on this, he's recounting that the Israelite leaders approached him and said, "Hey, let's go spy out the land." And Moses said, "That's fine." And so God says, "Okay, do it." So this is all done because the Israelites wanted it. The spies were an act of God's grace, NIV Study Bible says. John Gill says this concerning the Lord, quote, "who, rather permitting than approving, gave the following order, for the motion carried in it a good deal of unbelief, calling in question whether the land was so good as had been represented unto them, fearing it was not accessible, and that it would be difficult to get into it, and were desirous of knowing the best way of getting into it before they proceeded any further. All of which were unnecessary. If they would have fully trusted in the Lord, in his word, promise, power, providence, and guidance, who had told them it was a land flowing with milk and honey, then that he would show them the way to it by going before them in a pillar of cloud and fire." In other words, they had all they needed from God, but now they needed some natural help. Now, in my opinion, Gill's being a little bit hard on the Israelites. It's not sinful to use natural means when natural means are available. We know that from our Christian life. That's like saying, "God, I'm hungry. Please give me something to eat." And God makes something grow in the grass by the side of the road, and you say, "Oh, there it is." But then you don't go down and pick it up. You don't eat it. So it could be that. It could be they weren't really sinning, but it could be they were showing a lack of faith. And from subsequent events, we do see that they showed an awful lot of lack of faith. So it could be that God was just gracious here and not exactly responding to their faith. And that's an interesting thing. The faith message, people always make it very black and white. If you show faith, God does good things for you, which of course is true. But then they say if you don't show faith, God does bad things. That's not necessarily true. A lot of times God is gracious and condescends to our weakness. But at any rate, the spies are sent out. Now notice that they were leaders, but it's not the same tribal leaders that are mentioned in different chapters, like in verses 1 and 2 when the census was done, chapter 7, chapter 10. They had different leaders for different things, but here this was for spying. leaders of the tribes. They had leaders on the camp march of the camp. They were the same names, but here the spies were different. And that is probably because the task for spying required younger and more robust men, but nevertheless men who had had the confidence of the people, as the NIV Study Bible puts out. So the spies go out. The order of their names, there is no particular order. It's not according to the order of their birth. It's not according to the dignity of the mothers of their respective patriarchs. It's probably the order in which they went out to spy the land, but it doesn't really matter. Now, the 12 tribes, I need to mention this. Oftentimes we hear the 12 tribes, one spy for each tribe. We got to remember Joseph was one of the original 12 tribes, but he's divided now into his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which gives you an extra tribe, 13. But then you take one tribe away, the Levites, because they were the priests, and they didn't send out a spy. They weren't involved in military operations, so that brings it back down to 12. Now, I've got to present a bodaciously difficult problem here. Moses, in verse 3, sent the Israelites from the wilderness of Paran. Now, if you look at the map, you will see the Sinai Peninsula. And, of course, to the east of the Sinai Peninsula is the Gulf of Aqaba, and to the west of the Sinai Peninsula is the Suez Gulf. We're going to focus on the east side, the Gulf of Aqaba, and use that to orient ourselves. The Sinai Peninsula probably is down at the near the central southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, and then as you go up, and we've already gone up to Hazeroth, which is halfway up the side of the Gulf of Aqaba. And now, if you go up to the top of the Sinai Peninsula, at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, you see the wilderness of Paran, and that's basically where they are now. They've left Hazeroth, which is right north of Sinai, and then they've gone up to the wilderness of Paran. Now, to get our geography straight, if you'll look at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, go north up the Araba Valley, the Rift, and then you'll hit the tip, southern tip of the Dead Sea, which, of course, is very familiar. So the Gulf of Aqaba is a part of the Red Sea, and so I like to say going from the Red to the Dead Sea, Red to the Dead, there's the Gulf of Araba, and we look to the left of that rift, and we see the hilly, mountainous wilderness, the desert wilderness, okay? So at the tip of the Aqaba Gulf, as we leave the desert of Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula, the Sinai Desert, we hit the wilderness of Paran. And then as we go north of the wilderness of Paran, we hit the wilderness of Zin. So if you take the distance between the Red and the Dead Sea, between the Gulf of Aqaba and the Dead Sea, and divide that in two, you basically have the southern half is the wilderness of Paran, the northern half is the wilderness of Zin. I'm anglicizing it. I think that I had an Israeli guy pronounced it Tsin, and so I'm sure that's how you pronounce it. But anyway, I'm going to call it the wilderness of Zin. And now we are up to the southern tip of the Dead Sea. Now, if you go a little bit north of the wilderness of Zin, you get to the Negev, which is the southern part of Israel, the desert land south of Israel. And now you are to the west of the Dead Sea. So there's your basic geography. Now, in our passage here in Numbers, Moses tells us that he sent the spies out from the wilderness of Paran. We're going to see in other scriptures that the spies were sent out from Kadesh Barnea, and that when the spies came back, they came back to Kadesh. The problem with that is that according to most of the maps here, Kadesh Barnea is not in the wilderness of Paran. It's way up to the southern tip of the Dead Sea, right to the north of the wilderness of Zin, and to the south of the Negev Desert. So that those two places don't jibe. So I did some searching on the internet. It turns out this is a humongous problem. Here's some of the things leading to the confusion. There's a hugely difficult problem for archaeology and scholarship. First of all, there's a confusion between Kadesh and Kadesh Barnea. Are they the same place or not? Is Kadesh just a short name for Kadesh Barnea? And people disagree on that. And then the second problem is nobody knows exactly where Kadesh Barnea is because of the archaeology. Well, after wandering through the wastelands of geographical and archaeological scholarship, I've decided I can't solve this problem quickly enough to do this podcast before I die. So here's my simple solution. Kadesh Barnea is north of the Paran Desert, and it's at the south of the Zin Desert, in other words, on the border. So if that's true, then they left from the Paran Desert, and they came back to Kadesh Barnea. In other words, they left from Kadesh Barnea, and they came back to Kadesh Barnea. And so that's what we're going to use as our working hypothesis. Joshua 14:7 says this, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. So Joshua says he left from Kadesh Barnea. Moses says they left from the wilderness of Paran, and so it seems to me that Kadesh Barnea must be in the wilderness, at least at the northern edge of the wilderness of Paran. And we also see later on in Numbers 33 that when the spies came back, they came back to Kadesh, which may or may not be Kadesh Barnea. I assume it is. So anyway, that's the simple solution. We're going to go with that for right now. We go now to Numbers 13, verse 16. These are the names of the men whom Moses sent out to spy out the land. Those are the names I just refused to read to you because you weren't going to remember them. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So those were the names. Hoshea was mentioned, but there's a little exception to that because we're going to change Joshua's name to Joshua. Hoshea's name to Joshua. Now, this is a parenthetical statement anticipating the later prominence of Joshua. The reader is alerted to the significance of the name Hoshea, which was listed in verse 8, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, Joshua means the Lord saves. Hoshea means salvation or desire of salvation. So it's similar. It's fairly close. A little bit more personal when you say Joshua the Lord saves. And of course, that's the same name as Jesus, which means God saves. Joshua is the Hebrew version of the Greek Jesus, as the NASB footnote says here. The footnote in Hebrews 4:8 where it says, if Joshua had given them rest, the NASB footnote there says the Greek means Jesus. And I don't think that's controversial. It's interesting that Joshua is named Jesus. The Lord saves. Jesus is our Savior. He saves us in the New Testament. That's not certain whether Moses gave Joshua his new name before or after this. Joshua is actually mentioned by name as Joshua before this particular verse. That might have been in anticipation, though. We're not sure. So we don't know when Moses gave the name Joshua. Doesn't matter. He was, in fact, called Joshua in Exodus 17:9, which is a good ways before this. So Moses said to Joshua, but again, that could have been Moses writing down his new name. In other words, it could have been anachronistic. He might have been called Hoshea then, and Moses later called him Joshua. Now, this list of names, those names I didn't read to you, are spelled out. Now, usually a list of names is spelled out usually to give honor. But in this case, 10 of the names are later dishonored as being the spies who gave a bad report and got wiped out by a plague from the Lord for doing that. Only Joshua and Caleb of those 12 names still remained in high repute because they refused to go along with the other 10 spies, as we'll see in a minute. We go now to Numbers 13, verses 17 through 20. When Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. And of course, the purpose of that was to see how prosperous the land was. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. Now again, Moses says go into the Negev, that means north of the wilderness of Zin. So if they're at the border of the wilderness of Paran and the wilderness of Zin, that means they're supposed to go even north of there into the Negev, which is the southern desert country of Israel proper, the promised land proper. Then go up into the hill country. The hill country means that land in which was known as Edom, right there south of the Dead Sea, and west a little bit of the Dead Sea, right there into the hill country there. Remember, this is not only a desert. It's not like the Sahara Desert. There's a lot of austere mountains in this region also. John Gill says this concerning this idea of going into Negev first, quote, the Negev was, quote, the dregs of the land of Israel. And here, as he observed, the same, I don't know the he who is referred to here by Gill, but the same method was taken as merchants do, who, when they show their goods, show the worst first and then the best. I think what Gil's getting at here is Moses said, look at the worst first and then keep going. Look at the Negev first, that's bad. Then go up into the hill country, which is better. Now, this is basically a military spying operation because they're supposed to look at the fortifications, how many people are, and I guess I'm sure they mean soldiers. Well, people too. Just typical stuff that a military person would like to know. Now, this hill country that Moses wants the spies to go into, that hill country is inhabited by Amorites. Now, it's easy to get confused by all these ites. I've already gone through a lot of this height stuff in the book of Exodus, I think it was. But Deuteronomy 1:44 says, "The Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do and crushed you from Seir to Hormah." Seir is at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. Edom, the mountains that run from south to north up there right at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. So Amorites were there, and the Amorites were the big Canaanite tribe. They ended up in ancient Near Eastern history as a big, big tribe. They were the ones that were the red-headed type people. They weren't really Semitic. They were kind of light-skinned, and they ended up all in Syria, the Babylonian Valley at various times. But at any rate, this hill country that Moses tells the spies to go into was afterwards called the hill country of Judea, Luke 1:39. "Now at this time, Mary rose and went in a hurry to the hill country, to a city of Judah." I've driven through there with a tour guide. You go out of Jerusalem, going towards the west, and you go south, and it's very beautiful now. Of course, they've done a lot of agriculture and made it look nice, but it is hilly. It's nice. And then you head down south, and the hills get lower and lower, and you end up in the desert, but it's still hill country down there in the south. Deuteronomy 1:2 says, "It is 11 days' journey from Horeb," that's Mount Sinai, "by the way of Mount Seir," that's the mountain in south of, that's the Edomite mountain, south of the southern tip of the Dead Sea. So from Sinai to Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. So Kadesh Barnea is around somewhere. Again, that's a little bit confusing because we don't know where Kadesh Barnea is. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this word hill country refers to the southern and mountainous part of Palestine. Close enough for our purposes. Now, Moses wanted to look at fortifications. He needed to know that, of course, because he wants to know where he's going to settle. He can't settle where the land is held militarily by Canaanites. So notice that Moses, in asking for military information from spies, he's not just relying on the cloud, the Shekinah glory cloud, to lead him. He's using natural means also. And again, the cloud can lead them generally, but still, that's just generally. It doesn't say, do we take this little road here or this path here? It's not precise enough. Nothing wrong with using natural means along with supernatural means. Moses also wanted to know whether the land was fat or lean. That just means whether the soil is rich or poor, as Adam Clark says. He wanted to know about trees. Now, there were some uses for trees that Moses would appreciate. They could be used for building permanent buildings. They could be used for fuel. They could be used for growing fruit, all of which, none of which was available in the desert. They didn't have buildings in the desert. They didn't have wood for fuel. And they certainly didn't have time to plant trees to grow fruit. I'm just asking myself a question here. If they didn't have trees in the desert and they had to cook their food, what were they burning for fuel? And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe in 10 years when I listen to this tape again, I will know the answer, or I will stop and look it up or research it. Now, the time that the spies left for Israel was, it says in verse 20, it was the time of the first ripe grapes. Now, there were three times for gathering grapes: August, September, and October. August was the first time. September was the second. And October was the third. And this was the first, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. So that's somewhere in August that they went. John Gill says it was the middle of June, which is a little bit off. I read somewhere else August. We're going to go with August. It was hot in the desert, and those spies went out when it was hot. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says they left in August. They got back in September, and that's when the spies picked the grapes in the valley of Eshcol, right north of Hebron, near the Oaks of Mamre, the famous fat cluster of grapes, which is in September. We go down to Numbers 13, verse 21. "So they went up," that's the 12 spies, "and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob at Lebo Hamath." Now, I've already told you about the wilderness of Zin. That's the northernmost desert in the to the west of the Arab Rift, from the Dead and the Red Sea, from the Gulf of Aqaba to the Dead Sea. And so we're going to assume that they started out from there. Because remember, it says that they started out from the wilderness of Paran in the first of this chapter. Now they're going from the wilderness of Zin. So they must be fairly close to each other at the border. "They went as far as Rehob at Lebo Hamath." Now, Lebo Hamath is a place which is in the valley between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon range. If you go north of Israel and go to Lebanon, you just see, and look at an aerial map, you'll just see two mountain ranges that are right next to each other, and there's a valley that goes through those two mountain ranges, and Lebo Hamath, according to the BibleAtlas.org map, is right there just in the middle between those two ranges, but maybe a little bit to the north of center. Some people think it's not really a center. The NIV note says it could be translated as, instead of Lebo Hamath, it could be translated as toward the entrance to Hamath. Hamath was a city to the north of those two ranges up there as you head towards Syria. But it doesn't really matter. The point is, this is way up north. So the spies went all over the land, north, from the southern hill country all the way to the far north. That was a journey of about 250 miles up, 250 miles back, and it took them about 40 days, that might be a round number, to get back. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says from the mention of these places, the route of the scout, these Lebo Hamath, from the mention of these places, the route of the scouts appears to have been along the course of the Jordan in their advance, and their return was by the western border through the territories of the Sidonians and Philistines. So they went up the Jordan Valley and came back down by the coast, by the Mediterranean coast, where the Sidonians, the famous city of Sidon, right south of Tyre on the coast there, and then even further south of that, down into the Philistine territory as you're heading toward Gaza. And then they headed back east from there, according to the speculation, they headed back to Kadesh Barnea, somewhere at the south of the Negev Desert. Numbers 13:22. When they, that's the spies, had gone up into the Negev, that's the southern Israel desert, when they did this, they came to Hebron. Now, Hebron is a famous city, I'm sure you know. I'm going to stop right here and talk about that. It's halfway up the coast of the Dead Sea, to the west of the Dead Sea, right central, almost, not quite, to the center of the distance between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And, of course, you've heard of Hebron because it's famous, because that's where all the patriarchs were buried. The Jews say Adam was buried there, too. I don't know how they know that. They seem to know a lot of things we don't know. It had another name, Kiriath Arba, which probably means four cities, perhaps because it was divided at one time into four quarters. The Jews say, no, it's not that. It's because there were four patriarchs there, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Adam. Well, that's a bunch of tradition, but basically we know from the scripture that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were buried there. I think Sarah was buried there too, if I remember correctly. I'm pretty sure she was. Rachel was not. She died north of Bethlehem. But anyway, Hebron is a very famous place. In fact, it's still there. I mean, you can go there and look at all the what they've done with the tourist stuff there and put the graves there. It's famous. And that's where the giants headed out first. So they came to Hebron where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. And we'll talk about the Anakites in a minute, but they basically just think giants. And these are three famous giants, Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai. Now, here's a parenthetical note at the end of verse 22. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Now, that's interesting. Why in the world? Who cares? Why would Moses put in here, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt? Zoan is also known as Tanis, famous city in Egypt. Well, I'm going to give you three possible reasons why Moses did this. Option number one, this is from the NIV Study Bible. Perhaps Moses and the Israelites were, and the spies, were amazed at the size and the fortifications of Hebron. Because at the time of their ancestors, when Abraham was there, it was nothing but a bump in the road. Zoan was built back then. It was a big, fancy city. Hebron was small and insignificant. But now, Hebron was a big place, rivaling Zoan. Used to be just a dwelling and trading place for shepherds and herdsmen, a kind of a trading post. And now it's a Hebron and caught up to the mighty Egyptian city of Zoan. So that might be a good reason. That's the NIV Study Bible speculation. Here's John Gill's speculation as to why Moses did this. To abate the pride of those living in Hebron. The people of Hebron boasted of their antiquity. As Gill says, quoting Josephus, the inhabitants of Hebron not only reckoned it more ancient than any of the cities of the land, but more ancient than Memphis in Egypt, accounting it, Hebron, 2,300 years old, or counting Memphis 2,300 years old, and Hebron, according to the inhabitants, were saying, hey, we're even older than Memphis, so we're big shots. And so Moses said, yeah, you're a big shot, but we're about to take you over. Third possible reason why he mentions the fact that Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan was to abate the pride of the Egyptians. The Zoan, they would be very proud of their Egyptian city, Zoan. And if there was another city that was even older than Zoan, well, that means Zoan ain't such a big deal anymore. Those are all very interesting speculations. But it is kind of interesting how Moses just kind of throws that little parenthetical detail in there. We go now to Numbers 13, verses 23 through 25. Then they, that's the 12 spies, came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes. And they carried it, the cluster, on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That, remember, Moses asked them to get some fruit, and they did it. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. All right, Eshcol is easy to locate because it's right north of Hebron. In fact, it's right there at the Oaks of Mamre, where Abraham put his famous patriarchal grave. Why was Eshcol called Eshcol? Eshcol, because, as the NIV notes states, Eshcol means cluster. It was a cluster of grapes. In fact, the place Eshcol was probably named Eshcol later, and it's mentioned here in anticipation of its later name. In other words, they named it Eshcol because they carried the cluster of grapes there, or they cut down a cluster of grapes there. Now, this, we're assuming, is on their return from the 40-day trip up to the north and down to the south, and on their way back. They left in August, and they come back in September. As the NIV Study Bible says, presumably the spies cut the cluster of grapes on their return. Yeah, I think that's correct. It was a single cluster, but it took two men and one pole to carry the cluster. That means that is one bodaciously large bunch of grapes. Now, this large size of the cluster would show the great fertility of the land, which, of course, this is what Moses wants to know. How fruitful is this land that we're getting ready to take over? Now, Gill and Clark say that perhaps it wasn't the large size that required the pole. Maybe the reason for the pole was to carry the grapes so they wouldn't be bruised, not because they were so heavy they couldn't pick them up. So that sort of weakens the idea of how big the grapes were to show how fruitful the land is. I know most preachers say, wow, it's a fruitful land, you know, land of milk and honey. Look at all those big grapes. Gill and Clark are being party poopers there. We go down to Numbers 13, verses 25 and 26. They, that's the spies, proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron. They're still moving south, and to all the congregations of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And again, is that Kadesh Barnea or Kadesh? We don't know. And the wilderness of Paran, the northern edge of that is right at the southern edge of the wilderness of Zin. And so somewhere in there, where they started out from, they're back from their 40-day trip. And they, the spies, brought back word to them. That's all the congregation, all the sons of Israel, that would be their leaders, and showed them the fruit of the land. Now, this 40-day trip, NIV Study Bible says this must be a round number. I don't know why they say must be, but okay, doesn't matter. They proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Now, the first report of this word that was brought back, the first part of the spy's report was truthful. It was really a land rich in agricultural bounty, no problem. But the problem was their fear of the powerful peoples overrode that news of the goodness of the land. And that's why these 10 spies have gone down infamously into history. We go now to Numbers 13, verses 27 through 29. Thus they told him, they the spies told Moses, and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." Remember, Anak is a giant. The descendants of Anak are giants. "Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of Jordan. Oh, woe is us." I added that last part, but you see the tone that's going on here. Now, this bad report, we got to remember, is not by the 12 spies, it's by the 10 spies. Joshua and Caleb don't participate in this negative report. Now, let's look at the moral aspect of the spies' behavior. Adam Clark says that the 10 spies were, quote, destitute of valor, and, quote, dastardly, and, quote, cunning. Ooh, he paints them bad. Well, you could come up against Clark and say, well, were they that bad? They had enough guts to spy out the land. They were spies in a foreign country that could have killed them as soon as they got caught. Adam Clark refutes that, and he says, he refutes that comeback, and he says, quote, "It is astonishing that men so dastardly as these should have had courage enough to risk their persons in searching the land. But probably though destitute of valor, they had a sufficiency of cunning, and this carried them through. In other words, they weren't brave, they were just smart. Wow, that's weak, Adam. You know, you got 50 PhDs, and you're a polymath, but that's weak. That's really weak. So let's go to see what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about the conduct of the ten spies. He says that they were, quote, slanderers. Here's his quote. The report was artfully arranged to begin their narrative with commendations of the natural fertility of the country, in order that their subsequent slanders might the more readily receive credit. In other words, they just pretended to be objective by talking about all the good fruit, and then they objectively told Moses about all the problems that they would face, all the ites that were manning the countryside and the fortifications and the size of the people, the giants in the land. Well, I don't know what the logic of that is, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, because if you say that they were slandering the Canaanites and their land, why is that necessarily so? You got a land that's very fertile, milk and honey, big grapes. A land like that is naturally going to have a lot of strong people. So, and the Anakites were noted for having giants. They were giants. You got people that have a fertile land, they're going to want to defend it. So why would you say that the spies were slandering the Canaanites, telling lies about the Canaanite defenders? I would say that was fairly objective. Now, interestingly, in verse 29, the spies talk about the three geographical areas. First, the hill country, that's the mountains of Judah right there, this east of the Dead Sea, southern part of the Negev, the hill country. And then you got the coastlands of the Mediterranean Sea and the riverside by the Jordan River. So you got the plains by the sea and the rivers. And then you've got the Negev, the desert. You got Amalek in the desert in the Negev. You got the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites in the hill country of Judea. And then you got the Canaanites by the Mediterranean and the Jordan. So sea coast, water coast, hills, desert. Bad guys everywhere. Now, I'm not going to talk about the different ites. The Hittites, of course, were famous. They were the ones that had a big empire in ancient Turkey. Right about this time, some of them apparently had gotten way down there. Where we're talking about, the Jebusites were the old indigenous people that controlled Jerusalem before David ended up driving them out finally after our time period here. The Amorites were the famous tribe that were the red-headed, fair-skinned people, unlike the Semites, who ended up taking over much of Syria, even went over into the cradle of civilization between the Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates River in Mesopotamia. They're famous. And the Canaanites are the successors of the Philistines. We won't go into all that, but the point is they're bad guys and they're everywhere. There were enemies to the east of them and enemies to the west of them. In fact, we read in Joshua 11:3, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west. See, they were on the Jordan River Valley and on the Mediterranean coast. Basically, as John Gill puts it, the entrances to the land were all plugged. They couldn't get in there. So we go down to Numbers 13, verses 30 through 33, and we'll finish up this chapter. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, quieted the people. They're all upset by this bad report. Caleb said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. Now, that's showing some faith there, some confidence, positive attitude in the face of adversity. But the men who had gone up with him said, the 10 spies, we are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. Now, they're not so objective now. They were objective before, but now the land devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. Oh, everybody you saw was a giant, huh? There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are descendants of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. Now the exaggeration comes. Now the fear-mongering comes. Caleb spoke against that. Now, it was very reputable of him to do that. It's very hard to speak the truth when one is in a minority. Now, why did Caleb say that the Israelites will surely overcome the giants and the pagans and the heathens in the land of Israel? Why? Well, he had a supernatural reason. Remember, God had promised them the land. Those are the famous land promises all the way from the Abrahamic covenant. And so he believed that. We'll, that's what God said. We'll get it. He also had natural reasons to think that they would overcome the pagans. After all, they had an army of over 600,000 men fit for war, namely 603,550, as we know from Numbers 146. So Caleb had every reason to think that they would prevail militarily. Now, verse 31, it says, the men who had gone up says, we're not able to go up against the people. Remember, that's only the 10 spies, excluding Joshua and Caleb, who took a stand against them, said, we can do this. Now, this bad report that came from the spies, I've got a question here. Was this an objectively bad report given in good faith? I've already mentioned, kind of alluded to this. Or did their bad faith produce a biased report? Well, let's look and see what some of the commentators say. The NIV Study Bible says that it was bad faith. So this is option one. They were just basically lying about how bad things were there in Israel, in the Promised Land. NIV Study Bible says this, quote, by speaking bad things about it, the faithless spies were speaking evil of the Lord, because God had promised that they could get in, and now it was a land of milk and honey. Now listen to all this garbage these spies are speaking. The NIV Study Bible also says this, quote, the reference to the Nephilim seems deliberately intended to evoke fear. The exaggeration of the faithless led to their final folly. We seemed like grasshoppers. Well, that's some Hebrew exaggeration there. I mean, a giant. Oh, he's 7 feet. He's 8 feet tall even. And you're 5 feet. You know, that doesn't make you look like a grasshopper. Now, of course, supporting the idea that the spies spoke in bad faith, exaggerated the troubles the Israelites were going to have, is supported by Numbers 14:37. Those men who spread the negative report about the land were struck down by the Lord. They got blasted for what they did. So I think that's probably true. They slanted the report in an overly negative fashion, and so they weren't being objective about their military spying. I can make a case, suggest this, I'm not really going to defend it, that the spies were acting in good faith. They said, yeah, look, things are bad, but look, hey, we got to be careful here. We can't go marching in here. We'll get wiped out. In other words, I could say that the spies were objectively reporting a situation that was indeed objectively difficult. And then the subsequent disgruntlement in chapter 14 when the people complained, that was the people's fault, not the spies. We just told it like it was, the spies could say, and everybody says, whoa, woe is us. That's not our fault. Our job was to objectively tell you how bad things are. Yeah, things look bad. Well, that sounds pretty good, or at least plausible. But the problem is, even if they acted in good faith and reported objectively what they saw, they didn't act in faith. They acted in good faith, but not in faith. If they were not acting wickedly, they were at least acting weakly. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, either from, quote, timidity or malicious artifice. There's your two options. The spies were either scared, but good men, but just frightened, or they were evil. My personal guess is that they were just timid. They were scared. They were cowardly. I don't think they were necessarily evilly. They were exaggerating a little bit, but I don't think they had evil motives. They were trying to save Israel from getting wiped out, in their opinion, brought about by their weak faith. Now, in verse 32, the spies said that the land devours the people there. What does that mean? How does a land devour its inhabitants? Well, here's some options. I've got five of them. Option number one, the inhabitants were going to eat up the Israelites. That could be. That's my idea. Or maybe what the spies meant was that the barren and unfruitful land will cause the inhabitants to starve, as John Gill suggests. The problem with that, of course, as Gill immediately points out, is this would contradict their previous report of the land being a land of plenty, fat grapes. So they can't mean that the land's going to devour the Israelites from starvation. How about continuous civil wars? The land devours its inhabitants because they're constantly fighting each other. But the problem with that is, if that were true, that would make them weaker. That would be an argument for attacking, not retreating. So the Canaanites, the pagans, the heathen tribes are not devouring themselves with civil wars, I don't think. John Gill suggests option number four, the land devours the people because of diseases which kill the inhabitants. Maybe so. Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests option number five, the land devours the inhabitants because of the unhealthy climate. Well, how much of that is true? Where's the evidence of disease? Where's the evidence of unhealthy climate? That basically sounds like an exaggerated lie there. It doesn't sound to me like the inhabitants were getting devoured up in Canaan. It seems to me that they were very prosperous. Now we go to verse 33, and we take note of these famous Nephilim. I say Nephilim. They're mentioned in Genesis 6, where the sons of God came down and had sex with the daughters of men. And that has created that delicious theological controversy. Were those demons that did that, or were they the sons of Seth that did that, mixing the righteous line from Abel, from Adam and Abel, all the way down in Seth, the righteous line of Seth, with the unrighteous pagans there. And I've already gone through that controversy in Genesis 6. I know that I have an old friend who, unfortunately, has now become an expert in the phylum. He even told me how to pronounce it. He even told me he'd seen one time, which sort of raised the hair on the back of my neck. He saw a half-demon, half-human. How does he know that? Did he ask the Nephilim, hey, are you a Nephilim? Do you have a half-demon? Are you half-demon, half-human? Listen, folks, I'm not going to get into that. The point here is that the Nephilim were the ancestors of Anak. And Anak is who's there, the spies reported. They're there, all around Hebron. They're big, and I'm scared of them. That's basically what we're going to talk about here. Not because they were demons, but because they were big. We became like grasshoppers on our own sight. There you go. There's the emphasis on size. Now this name, Anak, the name is derived from the son of Arba, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, which is a great name among the Arabians, probably because Arba wore a great chain or a splendid collar around his neck. And so the word Anak implies this, some big guy with a big chain around his neck. I don't know. It's interesting speculation. Now, one last comment about this verse 32, where the spies said that the Israelites, the spies, were just like grasshoppers in the sight of the giant Anakites. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, Brown says about that quote. This was evidently a false and exaggerated report representing from timidity or malicious artifice. I mentioned that quote earlier. Were they scared or were they deliberately lying? I'll leave that for you to decide as we finish chapter 13 of Numbers. That gets us ready to go to chapter 14, verses 1 through 38. In the next audio, we'll look at how the people rebel because of the giants in the land, because of the nasty report of the spies. Another rebellion, like they haven't had enough of that already. Poor old Moses. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.